everyone. Welcome back to another episode of
Tag and Bag.
It's never not going to be cool to me. So just FYI, I'm always going to kind of fan out in that moment. Ladies and gents, thank you so much for tuning in. Jeff, thank you once more for jumping in again to our second episode of our jolly podcast that we've started together. Each and every week, we're going to be introducing a different theme, a different topic or idea that's going to kickstart our naturally segueing conversation that we seem to do so well together. This week, I wanted to dig into something that I think a lot of people might not know about you and your background, particularly in the industry, which is that, you know, you have such a storied history in the theatre. It's a real place where a lot of your work, as from what I understand from our various conversations, really grounded your career. A lot of the influences and things that really kickstarted your love for this came from theatre. And I think the big topic I wanted to delve into for this episode was about this notion of creative influence. Who are the people or what were the things that really drove you to this industry and this career path?
Well, I could go all the way back to when I was a child, like a lot of kids of the 50s, the 1950s, as I often say, I'm a visitor from another century. we only had so much in the way of entertainment and things that we could take advantage of when it came to like TV or films or things like that. But those things that were available, I absolutely embraced. So whether it was cartoons, which I adored, whether it was Disney or Looney Tunes or Rocky and Bullwinkle, which were extraordinarily bizarre and fun, or whether it was the movies I got to go see, both in the theaters and the ones that were on television or whatever it was, that was really where everything started. That plus the fact that I was, you know, sort of a hyper show-offy kid, the oldest of five, very much indulged by my parents. So I sort of had that going. And wherever I was, I found that if I wanted to be accepted, then the easiest way to do it was to be funny. So I would try to do that whenever I could. And then when I was in the fourth grade, in those days, everybody had like original Broadway cast albums for different musicals. We had Mary Martin in The Sound of Music, and we had My Fair Lady, and we had Lucille Ball in a musical that was not a success, but I loved the album, called Wildcat, Rodgers and Hammerstein. And I got a fourth grade teacher who would have us singing musical comedy music. So all of that was sort of there from the very beginning. It was no surprise then in junior high, when I was asked by the drama teacher, because I was hanging out with my friends at rehearsals, whether I wanted to audition. I said, sure. And after that, there was no turning back. I mean, basically, you know, the die was cast. I decided I wanted to be in theater. And, you know, my experience of theater was pretty much what was going on in school, when that, you know, wasn't terribly sophisticated. And we had a community theater, and the JCs was an organization in the little town I grew up in, would do an annual musical. So, you know, there was a certain amount going on, but not that much. Most of what I learned about, I learned from reading.
Right.
So it was reading biographies of various people who were, even when I was reading about them, it was like 15 years after they were, many of them, active, but I was incredibly inspired. And I read about the new-ish regional theater movement that really just began in the, really for the most part, in the early 60s. Few of the theaters go back farther than that, but so many of them really exploded on the scene in the 1960s. And so that was something to sort of look ahead to and aspire to. And I remember going to the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis and seeing a play by a French writer, Jean-Henri, called Thieves' Carnival, which I thought was one of the most amazing things I'd ever seen, as was that theater. So all of those things kind of conspired to nurture my interest in the theater, and it continued. I did plays in junior high, I did plays in high school, I did plays in college, and when the time came, a friend had sort of lured me out to Seattle. I didn't think I was going to come here, but shortly before I was temp, she said, there's a company out here called the Empty Space Theater. And they've got a couple of actors who have departed to go work at the Rep, the big theater in town. They're looking to replace them. Do you want me to get you an audition? I said, yeah, I guess so. I mean, might as well. I'm going to have to do this sooner or later. And I did the audition first for the artistic director and then for the other members of the company, because they maintained a company, as so many theaters did in those days. And I was asked to join, and it was just off and running. And I haven't stopped really since, as far as like performing is concerned.
Right. I mean, that is remarkable.
1975 was when that was.
75. Did you say fourth grade was your first kind of real exposure to it within the school system?
Well, we weren't really, I mean, you know, you would do certain things. Like, I remember there was a Christmas celebration of some sort in elementary school.
Yeah.
But it was a fourth grade teacher who herself performed locally in San Diego, where we were at the time.
That's what it is, isn't it? Is you get that influence. It could be someone that you perhaps didn't realize had that background, and it almost happens by accident, right? That whole thing where you realize.
She was a huge, huge enthusiast. And in fact,
yeah,
had a very interesting early experience because we had gone to see her. There was a theater. This was weird because you didn't see very many of these kinds of theaters. There was a theater in the Round in San Diego that did musicals. Really unusual to do that. But they were doing The Pajama Game, which is a show that everybody knew at that particular time. And the man who had starred in it on Broadway, for whatever reason, agreed to come and do it in San Diego, play the lead, John Raitt. And so we went to see the show. My teacher was in the show. She was playing one of the pajama factory workers, and she had a song called Her Is, where she's flirting and being chased around by somebody. I thought it was quite shocking, or at least my parents said I did. And then after the show, I was taken backstage to meet John Raitt. And the way that musical ends is there's this big fashion show of all the pajamas, and he comes out with the female lead. He's wearing the bottom of a pair of pajamas, and she's wearing the tops of the pajamas. Two can live as cheap as one is the idea. And then they all dance, and, you know, there's curtain call. So we went backstage, and he's still in his pajama bottoms, covered in sweat, which I wasn't even aware of, and we were fairly close. But when I was young, I didn't know that people sweated or spit or any of the things I've
sure, yeah. It's a whole lot of fluid going on there.
A lot of fluid going on. So he was very, very kind to me, and he was asking questions about, you know, my interest in theater and all that sort of thing. He said, how old are you? And I think I was 10 or something. He says, you know, I've got a little girl about your age. That was Bonnie Raitt, the singer.
What, just casually thrown into conversation?
No, he didn't say anything about it. He was just talking about his daughter. Because at that point, she wasn't Bonnie Raitt. She would later become
sure.
The great, you know, songwriter Bonnie Raitt. But I only realized that many, many years later. There have been many instances where you sort of bump into somebody and you go, yeah, who knew? You know?
Yeah, and it must be really surreal to have that sort of the hindsight of that looking back on it, right? So,
totally.
And that's
totally.
You've hit on a really interesting point there, I think, which is the idea that influence, teaching is such a powerful thing. A teacher myself, I know, for instance, I know that if I ever become jaded to working with young people, I know I that's my time to go. It's not something I think you can do if it's just a gig to you, right? And clearly, the kind of, you know, the look at the mentions across your elementary school into your high school experience, you know, they were indelibly influential on your career path, and it just shows the power of that. Do you still have a sort of an appreciation for some of those staff members, those teachers that you work with, perhaps a good director or someone that really, really struck a chord with you?
I would not say that the people who were in the various schools that I was in were particularly, you know, fantastic directors or designers. It wasn't that so much. I mean, I sort of had this obsession on my own. There were a few. There was one man at the University of Minnesota, where I went to school for a couple of years, who I thought was quite extraordinary. He was doing almost every school in every city, the big school, there's a guru teacher, and they're not necessarily people that, you know, sort of set out to develop a cult following. It's just that they're doing the most interesting work. So in Seattle, there was a fellow at the University of Washington named Arnie Zaslav, who trained all my friends, and he had trained with Jacques Lecoq in France, a very, very famous, you know, teacher of movement and mime. And he brought that back, and so all my friends got that kind of training, commedia training, things like that. Frank Galati, who directed the original production of Ragtime and Grapes of Wrath on Broadway, was the teacher, I think, in Chicago. And Wes was the teacher in Minneapolis. He was just so incredibly inspirational. Nice. And he was doing, you know, theatrical pieces based on literature, which at that point was still relatively unusual. And some of the stuff he did, for instance, an adaptation, a stage adaptation of an extraordinary book by Kosinski, Jerzy Kosinski, called The Painted Bird, Jerzy Kosinski. An extraordinary story about a young Jewish boy who gets separated from his family and ends up living with all these horrific people in Germany in the Second World War, or Poland. Anyway, you know, and it was turned into a theater piece, which was extraordinary. And he did one about a doctor in Vietnam called 365 Days. I mean, just amazing stuff. So that was hugely influential to know somebody like that. And I think then coming to Seattle and meeting the people at the Empty Space was unbelievably influential because, as I say, they'd all been, most of them had been trained by these two people at the University of Washington. And then on top of that, we were all children of that era. So we all shared the same touchstone, cultural icons and things. We, you know, that was just sort of what melded us all together.
Yeah, and that can have such a, that can have such a profound influence on the output of a, especially a repertory company, because you know what it's like in terms of, you know, you sort of, that the cliche of it being like a family is a cliche for a reason, because you spend such an intense amount of time together. And if you're all drawing from similar influences and your education's been shaped in a very similar way, it's inevitable you're going to gravitate to each other, and that's going to be a really effective collaboration between you all. You know what, and what an exciting experience for you too, to be working with so many like-minded people that had the same passion as you.
That's pretty much all I've ever been interested in. And it's only recently in the last few years that I realized that I was never really all that interested in being in the theater so much as I was interested in being around people that made me laugh my butt off.
Absolutely. And
that was what these people were. Plus, they were incredibly talented, imaginative, very brave in terms of what they would do on stage. You know, this is the theater in Seattle that back in the day was doing plays by Sam Shepard and Peter Handke. And we did the third production of a play by a new playwright named David Mamet, American Buffalo. And I was in it, you know, I mean, all kinds of stuff like that.
And Mamet, by the way, that's something I can throw. And Mamet, I think, is a remarkable playwright. So that's something I can completely connect with. That goes across generations. That's the kind of thing where when the work is that effective and that well written, it stands the test of time, right?
Yeah.
And what a great experience
for you. The early work, I think. The early work certainly does. And the work that's more male-dominated, because that's something he completely got, you know.
Yeah, so that, you know, going beyond that then, looking at this idea of, you know, you mentioned something earlier that I thought was really interesting too, where you said about how, you know, if there was ever an opportunity to go to the cinema, see a show, whether it was a live action in the theater, or whether it was, you know, going to a cinema, was, you know, would it be fair to say that was an important part, you know, that was an event for you, yes, you know, growing up? Yes. So is there, can you sort of speak to any particular types of film, theater, etc., that you would gravitate to as an audience member, less perhaps as a performer, but more as an audience member? Or was it that you wanted to take in as much as possible?
The second, the latter.
Right.
Absolutely. Oh, I mean, my God, it was like, you know, for me, if I could have gone to the movies every night of the week, I'd have done it. You know,
nice.
I
okay. love
films. And obviously a lot of ideas that I have about, you know, what a good acting performance is were based, you know, has been based on seeing so much stuff. Theater was harder to see early on because the only theater that was happening was, for the most part, theater we were making ourselves.
Right. Okay. And yeah.
Blind leading the blind. I mean, you know, it was all like, well, this is what I think we should be doing, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah, no, totally. You know? There's definitely a sort of a fumbling around in the dark that inevitably comes with that, working in that space. And if you've got a bunch of people that are willing to take that leap with you, it certainly becomes a, you know, a nice little safety net, even if you're in your little bubble working on something.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was kind of great. I mean, you know, in terms of the kind of work that I like to do, I you know, the wilder, the crazier, the longer, the bigger, the better. When I was one of the first things I realized fairly early on was that I wanted to be a director as much as I wanted an actor, because, as I say, my favorite part of rehearsal was all the way up until tech, and then tech was incredibly tedious to me. Mm-hmm. And then we had to open it, and I remember I was such an arrogant asshole. Opening night of a production, I turned to the leading actor. We were doing The Misanthrope, and I didn't care for the production all that much. And I remember turning and saying out loud, going, "Oh my God, we got to do this for 8 weeks." And then boom, we're on stage. It's like, what a jerk I was to even to the lead, to the
Jeff,
guy playing.
I there's something only I'm happy to put out there, because it's something I have talked about, not publicly, but people that know me in my own life know this, that I think, again, to speak to your point about directing, is something I really love too. I gravitated to the production and directing side of things more than the in front of camera or performance side. Even though that was my starting point, I loved writing scripts and directing shows. That's my true fire. And I think it was during a tech run. So I'm well aware of the sort of the, you know, when you have 73 sound and lighting cues and you kind of go, okay, this is just tedium personified. And I it was about hour four. And this is youth theater, by the way. So just so I'm clear on this, this is youth theater. Just to set up the premise of this is my own academy. So I've created this drama school myself, and I'm principal, I'm director, I'm running it. And I've got 26 teenagers that are in a production that I've written that I'm doing. And it's hour four in the tech, and it's just a bit shit. Like, it's not going well. And they know it, and they can see that I know it too. They've recognized, they've sort of seen my sort of slinking down slightly in my chair, and, you know, the body language is getting a little bit, you know, negative. And at one point I've never said something more that I've wanted to grab and then pull back into my face. But I just turned to my lead actor, who's this great kid named Ollie, who's wonderful. And I just went, right, Ollie, that there, just be better than what you are.
Oh, yeah. That's my favorite kind of a note. It's like, try it again, but this time be good.
Yeah, you know. Totally. I saw Jonathan Frakes, the actor from Star Trek, was on a podcast once talking about how he directed Patrick Stewart. You know, so Patrick Stewart being someone that's the absolute pinnacle of his career, a real acting influence on me, for, you know, no question. And he was talking about how he dealt with notes, because, of course, you get to, you're that kind of caliber with that kind of IMDb page, and you sort of wonder, is a director even going to dare say anything to you? But they've worked together for 35 years. They've obviously got that camaraderie. And apparently the way Frakes tells it is that Patrick Stewart would sometimes just turn to him and go, "I know, Johnny, act better." And Frakes would then sort of, yeah, if you wouldn't mind, that would be lovely. And I think that sort of, that ease of working and that ease of conversation is such an important part about anything creative. You can't be precious. You can't be sort of restricted in your ability to communicate. And it's where, ironically, not that I would ever say this within the school system, because I think I'd quickly find myself out of a job, but when they did the scene again of that moment of, you know, be better than what you are, they did. They were better, and it was great. And they had a great time doing it. So, you know, I certainly don't condone the choice of sentence structure, but I was very, very lucky.
Sometimes, you know, the assumption the directors know you know, the solution to every problem is just simply not true, as you know. You know, and sometimes it's like, just throw stuff at the wall, you know? It was Olivia, a very big influence back in the day. I mean, since I've sort of looked at it and gone, it's a little over the top. But back in the day, I thought, that's what an actor is. And he's the one that said, I would rather, you know, do the scene five times than talk about it. You know, in five different ways.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very smart thing to do, because the only way it's acting is if you're doing it. You can talk about it till you're blue in the face, you know, and a lot of people do, but that doesn't get the thing blocked. It doesn't get explored. It doesn't, you know, work out the back and forth between the actors who are doing a scene together. I mean, you finally just have to get up there. It's like getting on the high board, you know, to dive, and it's like, well, eventually you're gonna have to jump,
just do the thing. 100% that's something I very much do this, certainly in my secondary school teaching now. If I'm in a, you know, GCSE sort of, like, you know, end of high school,
right,
equivalent sort of qualification, and I very rarely, if ever, perform or demonstrate an example. I always think it's, particularly in the case of a drama teacher, which is, it is different to a director. It is a different relationship with the, with your students, that it always looks a bit like it's sort of a self-serving if I sort of get up and show how good I am. You know, it's actually more helpful if I let them try, fail, get notes, improve it. And again, by doing, they're actioning something. And that certainly was an influence for me. My teachers that I had at my school, John Pope, who was a fabulous drama teacher, who was a career drama teacher, 30 years here in the UK, and taught me that sort of economy of words when you're directing. Say the least amount to get to the best outcome. And that really stuck with me. That influenced me as a writer. That when I write a script, I always think with that methodology. And it's certainly, if I'm dealing with young people that have chosen it, they picked it as an option subject, I very much like the idea of sort of, you know, don't just sort of show off. Try, you know, let them experiment. Let them, you know, let them try, let them fail, let them then give you, that creates the opportunity for you to provide that guidance for them. And that's something that's very, very indelible, I think, to my own approach as a director. I was curious, actually, if it ever was any part of your work in the theatre, or I suppose any of the work you've then subsequently done as a voice actor, if any of it involved a sense of improv, if improvisation ever came.
Oh, I hate improv. I hate it.
Really?
I don't like to. Oh, no, I'm terrible. That's not entirely true. It makes me, the thing about it is that when you're working with a script, you know, it's like, that's just something to hold on to. When you're set out without a script, I find that, you know, very unnerving, because it can be wrong. It's like, well, you shouldn't be worrying about that, but I still do. I've gotten much, much better in my dotage with just, you know, great length, obviously. But when I was younger, I did. Part of the problem is that the only experience I'd had of improvisation was one of my teachers in one of the two colleges I went to. The way he taught it was, he had a big book of viola spolens exercises, and they were like, you know, he had these cards, and each card had an exercise on it. And so he would tell you what, he would just basically read off the exercise, you do it, and then he'd tell you what you've done wrong, which is like, fuck you, you know. I couldn't believe it. Now, years later, I was directing a show in Chicago, and my friend Bob Falls, who was the head of the theater that I was working at, said, well, is there anything you want to do while you're in Chicago? And I don't know how I happened on this, but I was very intrigued by a man named Paul Sills. Paul Sills was the son of Viola Spolin, who wrote improvisation for the theater. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the founders of Second City, you know, had worked with Nichols and May. He had worked with Alan Arkin. He had worked with Barbara Harris. In fact, I think he'd been married to her. All these amazing, extraordinary.
Arkin is a pretty remarkable.
And gap, so he was teaching improv, and I said, well, I would love to go and watch him do it, just because I'm so, you know, tense about this.
Yeah.
And so I said, we'll set it up. And they did. And I was told to go to the second city to this little stage that was next to the main theater. And I showed up early and I went and I introduced myself to Paul. And I said, I'm just going to go sit over here, you know, sit down in the bleachers and stuff. And it came time for the thing to start. And he said, Jeff, no, come on down here. And I was like, no, I'm just
no, thank you.
No, nobody wants you. Everybody has to take part. So I was like, So I went down, and Paul Sills was sort of famous for being almost, you know, astonishingly impenetrable. He would say things and people would go, what? You know, I, for some reason, was able to follow everything he said. And even though I wasn't always fulfilling, you know, the stuff that he had asked me to do, I recognized that when that happened. And he never made, and this is also not standard for him. He was famous for screaming at people and throwing chairs at them and stuff. He didn't do that with me. He was incredibly generous and gentle. And I thought, well, now if I'd had this at the beginning, you know, I might have very well into doing improvisation.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny you said that, because it sort of creates an inhibition, doesn't it? Just by virtue of it being so spontaneous. It's such a tricky proposition.
You know, I'd always felt, Jonathan, that, you know, what we were doing was we were climbing into the skin of somebody else. So it wasn't me. I mean, of course, it was all coming from me, but it was sure. Like, well, but I'm playing a character. And when that's taken away and it's like, no, all this stuff.
Oh, no, it's you.
Out of me, that's you.
Yeah. That's...
So I felt very, very exposed.
I feel that way about singing. I feel really? The same way about singing because of the idea that I feel like if I'm performing a play, I'm immersed in my character. I have my lines. I've done my rehearsal. If sure. I voice crack or I go off a note, I know I'm playing a character in this musical, but it was me that it was my voice that was either flat or, you know, that just went off key. And that's something I find very inhibiting because.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's kind of the it would be the reverse for me. And the improv for me is freeing. I really enjoy it. And it's because, my parents and then subsequently my teachers exposed me to things like Whose Line Is It Anyway, both the UK sure. version and the US version, you know, sure. Colin Mockery, Ryan Stiles, Wayne Brady.
Unbelievable. I sit there in awe of them. Now yeah. I probably admire them even more than Laurence Olivier because everything he did was planned down to the nth degree.
Yeah. Oh yeah, like, these guys are like, they're like, you know, the Muhammad Ali of improv performance, you know, like that. It's actually for me the thing I think that caught my attention is why I used to gravitate to actors like Robin Williams growing up and Jim Carrey. They were real influences for me, and I think it was the speed of their thought that was the thing that really got me. The fact that they were able to be so present, so spontaneous, and that, you know, you could spend a week writing a script that wouldn't even come close to the kind of one-liners they were throwing out in these instantly created premises, you know, and that's where I really kind of, you know, I really connected with that for sure.
Well, ironically, of course, you know, both my children, when they grew up, starting in high school, and then since then, they have both been involved in improvisation. My son is now doing stand-up stuff around his job.
No way.
And my daughter is working with an improv center in Buffalo, friends that she made when she was working at one of the three big improv theaters in New York, the Magnet Theater. She's a sensational improviser. Wow. And I watch her take a group of disparate people and somehow... She's my daughter because she's got a real directorial sensibility. She's able to sort of
nice.
Things may be going down a cul-de-sac, you know, where nothing can possibly happen, and she'll somehow extricate it and get it moving in a different direction. She's quite brilliant. They both are. They're extraordinary, both of them. And they have, you know, I don't know, they've got ice in their veins. They seem not to be bothered by doing it at all, you know.
What a satisfying success to be able to see that. You know, to see them. Just,
absolutely. Just I love, I mean, they make me laugh so hard. And of course, as I say, because I love comedy, it's like, it's another reason to love improv. Oh,
I love it. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for that. Yet another great discussion. for another episode of Tag and Bag. You can find us on all of the socials at Burly Bird Media, where we're on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, all of those fun, important places. You can find Jeff Stitzer at jeffstitzervoiceactor.com. His website has just launched, and he is also on Cameo, taking both, I think, are you doing the Zoom bookings through your website as well, the one-to-one?
Those are happening on my website, but nice. The Cameos are personalized videos, and unfortunately, I don't get to see the person I'm doing them for, which is one of the reasons I like the idea of doing Zoom calls.
Yeah, for sure.
So I can have this kind of a conversation with, you know, people who might want to chat with me.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again, everyone, for tuning in. We really appreciate your time, and we will see you in the next episode.